Hi, and welcome to the IDEMS podcast. I am Santiago Gorio, an Impact Activation Fellow, and I'm here with David Stern, one of the founding directors of IDEMS. Hi, David.
Hi, Santiago. What are we discussing today?
Well, I believe you were recently at an event on how to harness artificial intelligence and data governance for food security.
That's right. This was this World Food Programme event. It was a high-level forum on harnessing artificial intelligence, digitization, and data governance for food security and nutrition. It was a really interesting one-day event.
Where was it held?
It was in Rome at the World Food Programme offices, and it was the sort of event that I've not been to very often. It was an important interaction between civil society, government, the UN agencies. There was this whole sort of selection of, I suppose, voices that were being heard on what is really an important topic. And it was very interesting that even the wording of the topic was something which was brought up as an issue to be discussed.
How was that discussed? Because it seems to be very well defined in the title.
Yes, well, this question of whether it's a given that we need to harness artificial intelligence, what do we mean by artificial intelligence and digitization? Isn't the key question which some people were asking, how do we govern artificial intelligence? Can we govern artificial intelligence? There's a growing number of protests and civil society movements that are worried about the way artificial intelligence is being developed and how centralized that is becoming. And therefore, is this now ungovernable? What does this mean for data governance?
And when you say centralized, you mean by the big tech companies or more from a government perspective?
These are really good questions because, of course, the centralization that's happening at the moment around AI is really around the big tech companies and how the infrastructure that's getting built and the importance of that infrastructure. And the question about whether if the investment and the amount of the world's investment, which is going into these data centers and this AI infrastructure, whether this investment is going to get recovered, well, who's going to pay for it? How is it going to be paid for? And what does it actually mean in terms of food security? If our food security depends on this AI infrastructure, and the AI infrastructure is taking such a large proportion of the world's wealth compared to the food systems, how does that imbalance play out? What does this look like? These were really interesting questions that were posed. It's not a space I'm used to being in, but it was really interesting to be there and to hear different perspectives on this.
And part of the objective was to try to get more collaboration and getting more equitable access to this digitization and implementation of AI. Is that right?
Well, some of the, particularly the civil society movements that were present in this space, which is, of course, a UN space, that was their agenda. Their agenda was to make sure that their voice is heard and that they are able to be part of the process, whatever process is taken around these, well, what are really important steps which are happening. Nobody's disagreeing that artificial intelligence, digitization, and data in general are impacting the food systems, food security, nutrition. But the question of, well, in which way do we want to choose for it to impact as a society? Those were the questions that were being posed. And who should be able to decide? How is this governance happening? Who has power? Who does not have power? How is that decided? Were the important questions being posed?
And this strikes very much in my mind as related in some ways to the other events you went to a while back, but you did the mini series with Kate on the Earthkeepers versus the Empires. It seems like they're trying to not necessarily find alternatives, but consider the negative sides of AI as it stands now and what can be done in that context to make a positive impact on this area of food security and nutrition.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I attended because of the continuation of the previous event, as you say, the Earth Keepers versus AI Empires. And I was invited into this space as well. And it's really interesting that there's so much willingness to engage with and understand what is possible. What is this technology and what is it enabling? While at the same time, this big recognition that, well, actually, the level of centralization that has happened with the AI big tech, if you want, is very much aligned with and interacting with big ag, as it's called, which is the big agricultural industrial companies. They've been problematic for many farming communities because of the capture of seeds, the need to be part of a particular food system, which is what a lot of the civil society organizations have been fighting against in many ways. And so the relationship between big ag and big tech is part of what is being discussed. And one of the things which is so interesting entering into these spaces, which I don't know that much about, but is that there's a lot of interesting lessons from the interactions with Big Ag over the years, which are very relevant to the interactions with Big Tech. And yet there's some real differences. And of course, one of the areas that we come in, one of the things that we're very involved in is the fact that, unlike with Big Ag, where there's the breeding pipelines, they're long-term investment. And so you can't easily build local structures that compete with this. You can just build different structures. Whereas with the big tech, particularly on the AI, when you take the needs that a lot of people have, there are genuine alternatives which are coming up, which serve people's needs, where they do need these technologies. But they don't necessarily need the form of these technologies, which are being developed, put forward by big tech. And that's quite interesting. There are these alternatives emerging.
Can I take a step back? Because we're talking a bit in the abstract, and I don't see necessarily, and maybe part of the audience won't see necessarily, how this artificial intelligence is used or can be used for food security and nutrition. Can you say something on that to help frame this?
Yeah, there's so many different ways. One of the groups where I've had a couple of episodes in the past with Digital Green, where we've discussed the idea of what a farmer extension app or chatbot looks like. Farmer Chat by Digital Green is the best one that I know of. And that tries to get extension information to help farmers in their decision making. It helps them to identify pests, diseases as part of their farming practices. They can ask questions. And what's so interesting is that Digital Green was present. They were part of the panelists at the High Level Forum. And it is a really good example where not only is what they're doing of great value, but they're also building towards using small language models, which don't require big data centers. So their whole setup is, if you're going to get this out to farmers as cost effectively as they need to, they cannot use the big tech large language models because it just will not be cost effective. They have to be able to use those as part of the training process, but as part of the delivery, they have to move to the small language models, which are not energy intensive, which aren't requiring these big data centers. And so they're a beautiful example of a really powerful company built on these AI mechanisms, but where they're using what I would argue is next generation technologies, because they're jumping over the sort of data intensive piece. It's wonderful to see. Now, they're still in early days. There's a lot of work to be done. But it's, so let me see if I can reframe this. So Digital Green is a fantastic example of where not only are they using AI to give smallholder farmers services that couldn't be possible any other way, but they're also doing it in ways where it's going to be environmentally sustainable. It's not going to require these large data centers to run, to maintain, to develop in the long run. And it's very much got humans in the loop helping to improve these in sensible ways. So it is AI built in ways which are very much aligned with the contextualization which these civil society organizations are fighting for.
And correct me if I'm wrong, I might be outdated in my understanding, but the big large language models, the big tech companies, they're not necessarily trained on the type of data that is necessary for these local specific contexts. And that's one of the things that Digital Green is actually doing. It's getting data for specific contexts, so that it's relevant and the responses from the AI systems are actually context relevant.
Absolutely. So this idea that you need context relevance, that you need to be able to get data which relates to specific contexts to give the right information. You know, if you have a worldwide model for agriculture, then that really doesn't work because the contexts are just so different. Whereas a lot of what Digital Green are doing is to say, okay, well, what are the contexts we're working in? Within those contexts, how do we build something which serves this context? How do we iterate within the context to be able to use the local resources, the existing extension agents, the researchers, to be able to make sure that the information that's been given is locally relevant, locally adapted? And that, as you say, this is something where that might not be as available, because it might not exist online in the same ways. And it certainly will not be that easy for the large models to contextualize, because they're taking in everything. And so it can get drowned out by the noise. So these specifically tailored tools for local contexts, whatever that means, are really important. And it's part of what people are asking for. And the other thing that they're asking for as civil society is, well, if you're scraping the whole of the internet and you're taking information that just happens to be out there, whether it's copyrighted or not, and whatever licenses it's under, and you're scraping that to then provide that to people, well, not only might you not be providing the right local information, but you're also not able to give credit and actually trace back the work that was done, which is enabling this. Where does that data ownership lie? Who controls the data? Now, these are really interesting, difficult questions, but they become much easier when you actually have these smaller language model systems where things can be more traceable, when you can actually be saying, well, this is the data we're using. We can train on this data in this context. We can have something which is specifically tailored to your context, where people who are in your environment are the ones who have access to that, but those outside do not. And one of the things which I think is so important, and I knew very little about until last week, were these really big questions about the seed banks, the biological resources, the sort of genetic resources, and the issues around protecting that, and where you actually get the genetic diversity, which is so valuable, which is often maintained locally in specific contexts, while being valued and being actually a source of great wealth to the seed companies, who then patent it and then sell seeds which are adapted to specific conditions. There's all sorts of questions around that, which are a big part of the big ag, which I'm learning about and I'm not an expert on, but I'm starting to understand, which relate to and interact with and have been influenced by what's happening now with the AI revolution, how AI is enabling genetic resources to be reused, reimagined. There's a real worry that the treaties that took a lot of effort to be created and put in place, which protect genetic resources, they may be completely being bypassed by people digitizing those genetic resources and then them being published in such a way that they then get integrated into AI algorithms and can be used without being traced. So all the clauses for benefit sharing of those original resources are now potentially bypassed and lost. So a lot of work from the civil society trying to protect indigenous seed systems, for example, is also under threat in ways that I hadn't fully appreciated before.
This is perhaps on the opposite side. There are also big agro companies that own specific varieties, and you can only get those varieties from them. You can't even grow the seeds yourself to replant. You have to always buy from them. Is that something that was discussed as well?
That is, of course, a big part of that discussion, because this is the commercial side of the seed system, which is, if a huge amount of investment is made into producing new high-performance varieties, then there is a need to recover that cost. How does that cost get recovered? What does this look like as a business venture? And that is where the patenting of these genetic resources is such a well-established approach to this. So that is, of course, part of the discussion. Now, there's a lot of gray areas here, and there are a lot of people who are one extreme or the other. I cannot talk with great authority on this because I'm still just learning, really, about how the AI, the digitization and then the AI models are impacting that. What they're doing for these commercial seed companies versus the indigenous seeds rights, there's a lot happening and a lot seems new. And I don't understand all the ins and outs of it.
And it's the sort of thing where the technology develops too fast to keep the regulation and the legal systems on top of what happens as a result of these fast progress steps.
Yeah, and at the heart of the meeting is the fact that the speed at which AI is influencing these whole systems is something where nobody knows. Nobody knows how this is going to play out. Nobody knows whether things are going to be simply bypassing, as they have done with copyright law, simply bypassing the regulations that have been put in place, or whether the regulations in place are strong enough that things can be recovered and the legal cases can be fought. It's clear that this is going to be something which, I suppose, it'll be fought out in courtrooms over the next decade or so. In the case of these biological resources and the genetic resources, there's going to be interesting legal cases around this where the current treaties are going to be pushed as to what protection they are really offering in this new world where the digitization of the genetic profiles is leading to AI models being able to then use them in ways that doesn't necessarily recognize the origins and trace back how they're being used.
From what you're saying, I cannot assess whether you're talking about it positively or negatively.
I don't know. I mean, this is the thing. The general perception of the civil society is that this digitization of the genetic resources is highly problematic because it is unlikely that the products will then be covered by the regulation as it's currently in place. And so that is seen as being really problematic. But there is also recognition of the value other forms of AI can bring to the communities and to the food systems. And so this question of what are the right governance models? What are the regulatory frameworks? This is exactly where the World Food Programme has positioned itself as an enabler of some of these dialogues. This meeting was just a step in a long process where it will hopefully lead to regulation. It'll lead to actual policies being made by UN agencies and others to protect rights, but also to enable innovation. And that balance between the two is really interesting. And I should say that generally, the feeling at the end of the day was that there's a lot of common ground. A lot of people are actually really thinking about these things with nuance. They're aware of some of the challenges and the dangers that are there, but they're also aware of some of the ways things can be done in ways which could serve communities, society, indigenous communities, marginalized groups. There's a lot of unknowns, but there's also, we left with some hope from this meeting.
That hope towards what specifically?
That's a good question. Hope that the UN processes, which this is part of, will actually lead to positive outcomes, I suppose, is part of it. But I think more generally, hope that there's actually quite a wide range of people working from grassroots organizations through to the UN agencies with academia and lots of other partners who are understanding some of the challenges and opportunities that these technologies are posing and thinking about them with nuance in ways where society is not necessarily going to benefit. This is clear. It is absolutely possible that this becomes a corporate grab where society as a whole becomes worse off as a few individuals benefit. But the general sense was that some of us came back with is that enough people are thinking about this with nuance and aiming to serve the broader society that there could well be positive ways forward from this, both very practical, but also in terms of the regulatory and high-level structures.
Okay, so it sounds like a very positive event as a whole. Loads of really interesting people. I'm looking at the panelists. Loads of very interesting people in there. Any final key takeaways from the event?
The final thing that I would like to sort of highlight and say on this is we come at this from very much the perspective of building technologies, trying to use these technologies in responsible and ethical ways. And there is an urgency for that, where actually part of the problem that was identified is that there was a sense of inevitability that there are no alternatives, that if we want the benefits that can come, then there is only one way they can be obtained. Whereas we know, and others were presenting on, the fact that that's not a given. You don't necessarily need huge data centers all over the place to be able to get the benefits from recent advances in AI. In fact, the latest advances in AI, a lot of these can lead to things which could benefit society through smaller models that don't need the huge data center infrastructure that's getting built out at the moment, which is having negative environmental consequences and other things. So there is this sort of sense, and part of, I think, the role that I've played there is to actually remove some of the mystery about, well, what is this AI people keep hearing about? What does it actually mean? Does it have to be of a particular form? Or how can it be benefiting society in different ways without it coming at the cost of being indebted in many ways to certain corporate infrastructure that may not be serving society as people would want? That's a big challenge, but it does give urgency to our work, and it's very exciting.
Very exciting event. Thank you for reporting on it.
No, thank you.